Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
After a long weekend of entertaining family and friends at your home, things can get really dirty. Believe me, I know. So thankfully, there's Brush Hero to tackle those tough cleaning jobs. Brush Hero is a water-powered cleaning and detailing tool that connects to any standard garden hose. It's a product you're going to love because it actually works well. It's fun, fast, easy, and efficient way to clean. It's also American-made, which is a huge plus. You can use Brush Hero to clean virtually anything: boats, bikes, tools, grills, patio furniture, and more. Brush Hero is a great gift idea for Father's Day, or if you're shopping as a car enthusiast, or for motorcyclists, mountain bikers, anyone who loves smart American-made products. At BrushHero.com, they have a large selection of accessories, soaps, gift sets, and bundles. Something for every budget, especially with Father's Day coming up. So what are you waiting for? Right now, my listeners can get 15% off everything at Brush Hero. Visit BrushHero.com/pages/Laura. Use the code Laura at checkout.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Welcome to the Best of the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Thanks for listening. There's so many memorable guests and unforgettable moments from both radio over the years and this podcast. And I thought it'd be a great time to put some of this together so you have it at your fingertips. Conversations with my most incredibly scintillating guests, hilarious moments, all unforgettable. Enjoy it here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
One of the buzzwords of our time, so-called identity politics. No one knows quite what to make of it today. When the phrase is used, it's usually to wave away our attention from some of the things that make our lived experiences different and the political implications of those differences. Many of the objections come from the right, which is ironic at this time because the current administration has mastered the practice of the most divisive form of such politics, peak white identity politics, designed to drive apart people with common interests.
Believe it or not, people actually think he can be president of the United States. That's Pete Buttigieg, who's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Well, maybe in today's very tepid, milquetoast conversation, acceptable conversation. See, everyone is an unacceptable person needs to go away, just live in a cave somewhere. But in polite elite circles, Pete Buttigieg, his approach would come off as enlightened, and he's so genteel. It's so much less unpleasant than Donald Trump. By the way, if you have some skin issues going into the summer, join the club. We all do. Stay out of the sun if you can. I mean, big hats, wide-brimmed hats, under umbrellas. Don't spend a lot of time in the sun unless you're wearing protective clothing or SPF really high and good quality stuff. But after you're inside, you also want your skin to look good under makeup, or if you don't wear makeup. Men need better skincare. That's where my friends at Chamonix come in, who make the great Genucel line of products. I use them. I love them. Like, by the way, when I'm traveling, like my staff who's with me, they'll say, "Oh, you actually use this Genucel?" Because they're, you know, in my bathroom getting something. I'm like, "Yeah, I love it. It's awesome." The Genucel jawline treatment is a special formula with MDL technology. It's awesome. You'll love it. You put the jawline cream right along the chin line into your neck, and you're going to see the results. And right now, Genucel jawline treatment is actually free when you order the classic Genucel for under-eye bags and puffiness. And with its instant effects, you see the results in the first 12 hours, guaranteed, or your money back. So just go to Genucel.com. That's Genucel.com. Or text EYES1 to 77453. And for a limited time, Chamonix will include a second surprise luxury gift free. Again, EYES1 to 77453, or visit Genucel.com. That's Genucel.com. We're going to talk to our next guest, and I've been enjoying his book called White. Bret Easton Ellis is with us. Of course, he hosts his own fantastic podcast, which we love, and it's called the Bret Easton Ellis Podcast. The author of this new great, his first nonfiction work, and his other bestsellers, Less Than Zero, American Psycho. He joins us now. Bret, how are you? Good to talk to you.
I'm great, Laura. How are you?
I'm very well. We've been talking about. First of all, I feel like I know you. Isn't that weird? I feel like I know you.
That is so strange.
After reading 5 or 6 pages of your book over the weekend, and then devouring it when I had time on Mother's Day, I love the way you write. It's like right, it's in your face, but it also takes you behind the scenes, which I love, with all the little salacious details, which of course we gobble up on Sundays when we have a little time.
But
I love the book, and I just started reading it like late last week, so it was a real treat to read it. So congratulations on
that.
That's
great. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, really fun, but also provocative. It makes you think. But what we were talking about earlier, and it's perfect for your appearance on my podcast, is how there are very few liberals left today. I mean, there are not many. I mean, my friend was Nat Hentoff, of course, a phenomenal literary critic, writer, thinker, passed away. Christopher Hitchens, one of my other dear friends. He's a true liberal, I think, in every sense of the word, wanted more speech. But, you know, he described himself many times as a socialist, but he was a free thinker. But today it's either you're conservative or you're left wing. But that liberal space of more speech, less control is, I don't know, that's diminished. Maybe Glenn Greenwald would be another.
Well, I don't know. I feel that's where I've always been. And I feel, as someone who's, you know, not on either side of the aisle,
yep,
that I have been pushed into being some sort of conservative freak by...
You're not. Read his book. You're going to know he's not a conservative. Anyone who thinks he's
people.
A conservative, read his book. He's not. I'll help your reputation there, Brett.
Including the person I live with, who is a far left, you know, Trump derangement syndrome millennial.
Oh well.
So I find myself as being pretty middle of the road at a certain point, and then sometime after 2016, after the election, when I started to think about this book and began to write it, that things had changed, and that whatever sort of progressive person I always felt I was to a degree has been pushed by many people way into a different side of the aisle. And it's such a strange place to find myself in, because I really don't see myself like that. But these are the times, and this is what has happened. And I do not know what has happened to all the liberals that I used to know, true liberals like the ones you're talking about. They've warped into something else, and it's a little stressful.
Well, it can be very demoralizing, but in another way, it makes things kind of more high stakes, because if you're actually just going to be out there and answer questions, someone says, well, okay, Donald Trump's the worst person ever. He's really idiotic. He's stupid. The whole economy is going to collapse. And you say, well, I don't necessarily agree with everything Trump says, but gosh, all those projections of the economy collapsing and all these really smart people like Paul Krugman, they were all wrong. I mean, do we ever revisit all of those predictions? And you're a hater. You like Trump. Trump's just a horrible person. Okay, but let's assume he is a horrible person, but that he's really good at running the economy, and that wages are going up, and China's now forced into this position where they have to probably at some point make concessions. I mean, but there is no rational way to have that conversation in today's culture, because the second you say Donald Trump has done something that is actually pretty courageous in the face of Wall Street pressure, which is take on China.
Yes.
Then you're just a horrible person. Then you can't eat. You never can recover in this current culture. It's almost impossible.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane. I write about this exactly in the last chapter of White.
Yeah, I saw it.
This notion that, you know, I remember in November and December of 2016, all of these dire predictions that everything was going to, you know, disappear into this apocalypse because of the Trump presidency. And I talk about how, looking back at that time from the summer of 2018, you know, two years later, that none of this had happened. None of this had actually happened. And I do think that the people who have Trump derangement syndrome, and I use that term freely because it really is true. Mm-hmm. I've seen it in friends here in Los Angeles. I've seen it with my partner. I think so much of it has to come from the fact that they simply don't like the man. That the policies, whatever, they, you know.
Doesn't even matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about, I mean, my partner was really, really big on prison reform. That's all he talked about, prison reform, mm-hmm. prison reform, prison reform. And then when Trump does his thing about prison reform, it doesn't matter. It's Trump. It absolutely doesn't matter. Whatever he does is wrong. Everything he does is wrong. And it really is this resistance that appeared really, I think, overreached. And that's something else I write about in White. I think they've overreached to the point where they really messed up. I don't know any Democrats, quite honestly. I had dinner with one the other night who really don't think that he is not going to be reelected in 2020. And this is a very interesting thing that happened. And I think the one very smart guy who I had dinner with on Saturday, you know, Harvard, in the Brooklyn liberal bubble, I've known him for 35 years, he admitted, he said, I think we overreached. He has total Trump derangement syndrome. I haven't seen him since before the election. And he said, I think we overreached. I think we got so crazy that we lost sight of things, and we lost sight of finding someone electable against Trump. So I don't know.
Well, there's no sense that they've learned a thing, though. I mean, I actually think, and people say, well, look at the midterms. Midterms have zero relevance to what's going to happen in 2020.
Totally,
Obama got wiped out in 2010, and he trounced Mitt Romney, who was like Thurston Howell III, you know, running against a cool cat. It was just never like Lovey. Where are we going? Where are we going to go to our five homes? That never was going to work. But I think Trump, in a way, and this is weird, but I said this the other day, Brett, and I actually believe it. When you listen to Pete Buttigieg, who could be the nicest person. He's
sure.
A sweet, nice person. I'm sure he is. But it seems like everything's boring after Trump. That sounds really totally Philistine. But it's just like everyone else is like,
well, we have to have a real conversation about identity politics and what this means and how we...
And Trump just comes in like a bull in a china. He's like, you know something? I'm calling bullshit on all of you. I'm just calling bullshit. I think you're all full of it. America's back. We're not going to give in to the Chinese, just like we didn't give in to the Soviets. This is ridiculous. You know it. I know it. And so he kind of does talk like regular people in an age where social media has brought the level of conversation down to kind of the brass knuckle, you know, it's kind of nasty to say, you know, to be obvious. It's very obvious that it's nasty. But Trump cuts through this politically correct meringue that's just like it's sticking to everything. And I think for a lot of people are just sick of it. It's refreshing to a lot of people.
I think it is refreshing. And the other thing that people I know, when we do talk about Trump, hate hearing is that I think he's funny. I think he's really
very
funny.
He could have been a stand-up comedian. Absolutely could have been Don Rickles.
I think the rallies are remarkable examples of kind of a stand-up comedy act, and they are refreshing because he doesn't speak in platitudes. He doesn't talk in these, you know, I saw, for example, this morning, Elizabeth Warren put out all of these tweets about how...
Oh, God, Brent, how dare you? How dare you, Brent? That's just so unfair. My pawpaw said I had high cheekbones. Dare you, Brent?
It really is like having the strictest librarians running for something. And it's just so dead compared to how free Trump is. And that's what I see in Trump that I don't see in any of the other candidates. Who are like desperately trying to present this image of themselves as so pure and clean and, you know, rehearsed. I see a kind of freedom in Trump. And whether you like him or not, just to acknowledge at least that he has this skill, you know, in terms of communicating to people, no one can do. And I think this is the downfall. Not being able to grasp Trump fully is the downfall on the left and on of the resistance. And again, I live with that resistance, so I can see what has happened, 24/7 in my life. But that's the problem. Not being able to get what people like about Trump is, you know, is kind of the insanity. I remember that dinner on Saturday night. My friend who was
I wish
kind
I was
of
there
that I was
I'm coming to dinner with
there.
You by the way next time I come to LA we're having dinner we're going to like just okay. cause a huge ruckus somewhere together that'll be fun
yeah so, he was saying I said to him come on you don't know a single person who supported Trump or voted for Trump and he looked at me like he was bitten by some kind of rabid zombie and said no absolutely not Now, it's weird. I live in L.A., and I do know a lot of people who supported Trump, and I know a lot of people who don't. But, you know, this notion that you live in such a rarefied bubble that you don't know anyone, you can't stand in anyone else's shoes, is, again, a problem with the resistance. And I don't know.
One of your other faves, Kamala Harris, was at the Human Rights Campaign L.A. dinner last month. I know you've been to those dinners. A lot of fancy, very, very influential people show up. It's a big honor to be celebrated at these dinners. But she made this statement. Let's listen.
Right now in our country, we have seen a level of hate rise like we have not seen in a long time. And in these last 2.5 years, it has received new fuel. We have seen and know to be true that the existence of homophobia, transphobia, racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia are real in this country. And we must speak that truth. And that whenever anyone is the subject of that hate, which we know has reached lethal proportion in our country, that we must stand together and never let anyone stand alone in their fight.
Thoughts?
Absurd. That's absurd. And it really is terrible that Hollywood has decided that she's the candidate that they're throwing all of their money at. A total waste. A complete waste for that candidate, and just an example of where Hollywood thinks it's so progressive, and they're not getting it. And that kind of rhetoric is so absurd, and that rhetoric is the kind of thing that fuels hate. I don't know. I mean, this my disillusionment with the left has I don't know. I like to think it's subsided somewhat since reaching a peak irateness during the summer of 2018, but every now and then when I hear something like that, I think, oh,
no,
God.
It's going to get much worse.
This is what you're running on? This is what you're running on.
This their argument is in a nutshell, Brett, this. He's a horrible, awful, rotten person, and if you support him, you're a horrible, awful, rotten person.
Yes.
Vote for Kamala Harris 2020. That's it. They're not arguing their policy is going to make America stronger, or the GDP is going to go up, or China will be back on its heels. They're not making any of those arguments.
I keep referencing my partner, but I live with this conversation every day. This is why it's not going to work, because, first of all, you don't have anyone electable, and also you're not running on you have no coherent policy, and you also don't have anyone, and again I say this, with the charisma. Whatever you think of him, the charisma of Trump. And, you know, Trump, you know, look, again, that friend on Saturday night, you know, said, you don't understand. He's a very bad man.
That's it.
I was kind of nodding. Yeah, whatever. You know, what about climate change and the Supreme Court? And I kind of looked at him and I thought, you know what? He got elected and he will probably be reelected. This is what happens when someone wins the presidency.
What are they going to do? Yeah, what are they going to do, by the way, if he gets reelected? I mean, we have to all build bunkers somewhere, because I don't know. They're going to burn a city down. Like, I don't know what these people are going to do. I mean, they were basically in crying rooms all over American universities. Georgetown, which is about 5 miles from where I'm broadcasting, they canceled class and they brought in grief counselors for the next 3 days at Georgetown. It was embarrassing. Completely.
Laura, I mean, here in Los Angeles, most of the agencies shut it down. And we got emails from our agencies saying, if you can't come into work today, that's totally understandable. We have people you can talk to if you decide to come into work today. I mean, it was like 9/11. I mean, it was this crazy overreaction to an election where, you know, someone loses, someone wins. And then you look to the next cycle, you look to the next election, and you try to get your person in. And again, this is really what white is about. White is about the overreaction culture and this hysteria, mm-hmm. and how I don't think it moves the needle or gets you anywhere. And what gets you places is, you know, cunning, smarts, a kind of chill calmness in terms of planning out how you want to navigate your next move, but not this. I mean, this is... You know, on Saturday again was talking about, mm-hmm. I was at the Javits Center.
Oh, God, I wish I had that video.
You don't understand what it was like. It was like the only equivalent I could think of in Manhattan was 9/11. There were people, when it was announced that Trump won Florida, there were women wailing.
It was the best night of my life. No, it was among, other than adopting my daughter and going to Guatemala and seeing her for the first time, that and, wait, what else? Then adopting my two sons. I mean, other than that, that this being at the Hilton and seeing the faces of the media standing about 2 feet behind me because I just got off the set at Fox and turning around and looking at the New York Times. And I don't think I literally, it was one of the most fun. It was like New York, it was funereal for the next 48 hours. Absolutely funereal. I loved every minute of it. All right, here's what I love this part of your book. Okay, this is page 137. Anxiety and neediness became the defining aspects of Generation Wuss. And when the world didn't offer any financial cushion, then you had to rely on your social media presence, maintaining it, keeping the brand in play, striving to be liked, to be liked, to be liked, an actor. And this created a further and ceaseless anxiety, which is why if people were snarky about this generation, they were simply written off as a D word. Case closed. No negativity allowed. We're only asking to be admired in the display culture we were raised in. But this excuse is problematic because it limits debate. If we're all silenced into liking everything, the millennial dream, won't we instead be having boring conversations about how great it all is and how often you've been liked on Instagram? I just love that. Generation Wuss is where we've arrived, frankly.
Look, a lot of that came from living with someone who was a millennial for the last 10 years. And it was, I noticed that there was a profound difference in a reaction toward things and that so many more things triggered them than they did me. And I wondered why this was. And so I really actually did do a fair amount of research on millennials for this part of the book. But you know, this has been proven again and again, this my writing about millennials, or what I termed on my Twitter account, Generation Wuss, proven again and again in the reaction toward this book when it is written about by millennials. And some of the most caustic, hostile reviews were from millennial writers who just lost their shit over this book. And they were just went completely nuts, writing 3,000, 4,000 word screeds against me, against this book, how I'm irrelevant, old, white, how could Random House be publishing me? And then talking about this for 4,000 words, how I'm completely irrelevant and what is this all about? So it's these reviews seem to be almost like Exhibit A of what you just read, this complete like denial or rejection of any kind of conversation or debate that would be about the flaws of a generation, the shared flaws of a generation. So, I really thought this was going to be one of the least controversial sections of the book, and it has become in many places here, the UK, in France.
I think people agree with you, Brett. I think I've got to say, Brett, I've tried to add it up over 20 years. I think I've employed 500 or 600 millennials. Millennials in the, what's the new generation? Generation Y or whatever?
Z or Z? Y? Yeah.
I don't know. Whatever the 20-somethings now, are they still millennials? No. They are. Okay. So I've employed a lot of people. And without a doubt, this generation, I sound like a fuddy duddy, I don't care. This generation does not have the same. It's a work ethic or they're not as unafraid in many ways. Everyone's afraid of offending, or you're afraid of feeling. It's almost like you're afraid of feeling anything, and you can't accept the fact that, look, like I said to a good friend of mine, like, you know, your kid's never gonna. I played a lot of sports in college. I was pretty good. I said, your kid's not going to be a soccer star. Sorry to tell you. So upset with me. I said, look, it's all right. Your son is brilliant. He's going to be hugely – he's a great kid. But why maybe not push him into play soccer? He's very talented. I said, okay. He's not going to be a great soccer player. It's probably better to do something else. Carting these kids around to all these soccer games. But parents cannot take the fact that their kid is not going to be a Division I soccer player because they spent – $80,000 on private coaches and all this stuff. That's just one little example. But, and if you speak the truth, because I actually know a lot about sports, if you speak the truth, they're like, oh, I can't believe you just said that. Well, I'm trying to help you here. They don't want to be helped.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do think that there was a reaction against the way we were raised in terms of so many parents I know who are, whatever, Gen Xers, yeah. who felt that they needed to overcompensate because they didn't get that kind of
love.
I don't know, or love or attention from their boomer parents, and that they were not going to let that happen to their children. And so there was this kind of, I know these are all cliches, helicoptering parent, the coddling and all of that stuff. But I do think that this happened and that it did create a generation of kids who are, I guess, the opposite of what we were to a degree, but, you know, free range, that we had this kind of, you know, this childhood where I really don't feel that there was this kind of parental attentiveness in my life.
No,
that
I loved
kind
it
of
that
hobbled
way.
Me. I remember just being like on my own a lot.
Me too.
And my parents didn't come to every rehearsal
right.
or school play and post it on Instagram. I was on my own.
Me too.
And
I liked
feel it. That aided in me growing up and becoming an adult. And I see this kind of like, whatever, this childlike reaction to the world among so many millennials that, oh my God, is it really this unfair? Is this really what's happening? It doesn't work out the way I wanted it to. And that leads to, you know, this kind of inertia in a way.
Or kids, you know, they'll come out and say, I feel stressed. I'm very stressed
out. Stress and shame. Shame is a big thing. There's a lot of shame in terms of how, you know, they deal with social media and if they're not liked and if they're not, if they don't have enough followers and if they, their Instagram post didn't get enough hits. I see shame as a big part of it as well. And just an inability to deal with the realities of the world.
I like what you said in the book. Not everybody's going to like you. A lot of people hate you. Like I grew up, I mean, I grew up, you know, being kind of rough and tumble tomboy. So I literally did not care if people didn't like me. I don't know what that
I
is.
Literally
but I
literally did not care either. And
I don't
I care.
Care
at all.
To this day, I
Even
could care. Everyone's like, aren't you upset? I said, no, I don't care at all. Like, oh, no, LeBron James said this. I said, bring it. You know, who cares?
This is what my millennial partner doesn't get. Like, oh, aren't you upset that these reviews were so bad? I mean, I don't. I don't care if people like me.
I have a question. I have to ask you a question, Brett. How are you with a millennial? I don't understand that. I mean, I don't want to get too personal
but I talk about it in the book.
I don't get that.
I know, and it sounds like a bad sitcom. It sounds like crusty old Gen Xer and progressive young liberal millennial are at odds in their West Hollywood condo all day. But it's not really that. You have to have a lot more for 10 years that's going on despite your differences in terms of what your generation is or even really what your politics are. I've learned. You learn something. I might not agree with a lot of stuff, but I listen and I do learn something and I am empathic. I'm not sure that they are so lost in their hatred right now and their bewilderment about what's going to happen that they don't have that openness. But
a friend of mine said to me, well, you're dating someone, you know, you're dating someone much younger. And I said, so what do you do? Like when you say, well, where were you where King was shot? Martin Luther King. And then she says, what? Larry King was shot? Like, what are you talking about? No, Martin Luther King. Like, and there's a big, like, cultural, like, you know, touchstones aren't quite there. But look, I have a friend of mine who's 55. This is with a guy who's 82, and I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is ridiculous. They're like my favorite couple. So I've slapped myself. Cause like, well, how dare I? It's natural. But how dare you come to have these preconceived ideas of what works for people? But they're like literally among my favorite couples everywhere. So, Brett, what's next for you? This book was fantastic. It upset all the right people, in my view, except maybe your partner. So what's next? What are you going to do next? Your podcast?
I'm going to be working on another book this summer. And also, we have taken a break from the podcast. So the Brettie Snell's podcast will be coming back next week on Patreon. Mm-hmm. And that actually is enough. That's a lot. And also, of course, the usual vagaries of Hollywood, trying to get money for a movie and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But basically, a new book and the podcast are what I'm focusing on now.
Brett, before we let you go, it's kind of like going back to, days of American Psycho and cinema in the United States. And it does seem like there is just today it's like art house films and comic book characters made into movies. I mean, there's I don't know. I know there are interesting films being made, but I feel like everyone's censoring themselves, and the culture is what we are. Well, it's what we become. So you can't really complain about it. It's like it's all around you. But I'm not moved by a lot of what I see, at least made in the United States. And maybe that's pathetic, maybe, but it doesn't. I don't go to comic book stuff.
But what you said is true. It is either art house and prestige pictures that come out for award season that really don't make anybody any money, but they get a lot of attention during that crucial award season, or it is purely Marvel movies and big animated movies for families. So the kind of cinema that you're talking about that I think we both grew up with during that fantastic decade of the 70s, the golden age, is
Serpico.
Gone. It just doesn't exist anymore.
I watched Serpico the other night. I haven't seen it. Oh, my God. It's just like a lot of movies.
Yeah, so good. Not happening now. No, not getting a big start in a movie like that. And if you are, it's a kind of watered-down version that's on Netflix, and that's not fun.
Oh, no, the Obamas are going to deliver the next great online film. Michelle's going to be doing it.
I don't know.
The next one. Brett, come back soon. Loved having you on. Love the conversation. And I just think we'll see where this all goes. But I feel the anger and the viciousness rising, not subsiding, and it's only going to get more desperate if which I believe this economy will continue to grow going into 2020. I think they're like fresh out of ideas, and so they're just going to turn up the rhetoric on Trump, so that will lead to more derangement syndrome. Best of luck, and you have a decade-long relationship. You're beating me there, Brett, so that's great.
Well, listen, Laura, thank you for having me, and let's do it again soon.
I hope you're enjoying this. The Laura Ingraham Podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Email me with your thoughts, or if you want to get on the show, just email me the topic you want to talk about or react to the topic we're tweeting or Facebooking out. ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Keep the comments coming. Thanks for listening to the best of the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Men of Morehouse, you are surrounded by a community of people who have helped you arrive at this sacred place and on this sacred day. On behalf of the 8 generations of my family who have been in this country, we're going to put a little fuel in your bus. Now, I've got the alumni over there, and this is a challenge to you, alumni. This is my class, 2019. And my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
Well, this was a big deal. This is about $40 million and an act of charity, which Robert F. Smith, he challenged others to follow suit and also do the same thing. Donate to people who, when freed up from debt, can go on to do great things. It'll be interesting to see what happens with those students and maybe compare them to other students who are themselves saddled with college loans that may be difficult to pay back. And just separate matter, I think we have to rethink the whole four-year college thing. It doesn't necessarily seem required in today's economy. It really does. Not for everybody. And one of the students from Morehouse who, after hearing this, his reaction.
I have a degree, and I'm tuition free. That it was shocking. I thought he was joking, and so we all looked around like, "Wait, what?" And so after a good minute, we were like, "He is serious," and everybody just started crying.
Well, joining us now, I'm delighted he's with us, Stephen Auth. His book, "The Missionary of Wall Street," and the chief investment officer at Federated Investors, and he's also experienced as a missionary, the word of Christ, spreading it on the streets of New York City, and how his experience has made him more successful. And you find that when the more you give, the more you benefit, which is kind of a selfish way of thinking about it. But I've always found out that that's the case as well. And he joins us now. Stephen, how are you? Good to talk to you.
Likewise, Laura. Thank you for having me.
What today are we getting maybe not right? Or I hate saying wrong because that sounds so negative. But what are we getting wrong about charity today? Like the average person who maybe has, at the end of the year, maybe has $5,000 if you've had a really good year that you want to give away for just an average middle class family. What do we do right and what do we do wrong with our charity?
The charity that, well, everyone's got their own charities they give to, and I think that's terrific. To me, the real poverty in this country is spiritual poverty. Hmm. So the focus of our mission in New York is really addressing spiritual poverty. I mean, even I think Mother Teresa said that when she came over here. So, I myself, and I know you do, give to a lot of charities where people are in need. But a lot of those bases are covered in our country. You know, this is not a third world country. But what I find on the streets of New York, I mean, people ask me about this mission, and they're assuming we're doing it in the South Bronx or, you know, some, you know, impoverished area of the city. We're actually doing it in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city, in Soho.
And Old St. Patrick's, right? You're near Old St. Patrick's, right?
Absolutely. We're centered around Old St. Patrick's. Mm-hmm. You know the church, I'm sure, right?
Yep. Yeah. When the people down the street that you encounter, we tend to walk by people and maybe we'll buy them a sandwich or people throw a dollar at people. But, you know, I think it's hard for most people to confront that deficit. Well, they have it in themselves. We all do to some extent. And then society, whatever that means, society today, it's like, oh, well, you can't foist your views on others. So the idea of even being a missionary in society, unless it's a missionary of, you know, against climate change, or if you're a missionary for recycling or against plastics, and that's okay, but or for animals maybe, because that's kind of a popular thing to be advocating for. But if you're a missionary for Christ, you get the sense that, you know, the elites in society think that that's too much. You're foisting your narrative, your religious narrative on others, and that's another thing a lot of people confront.
Yeah, that's why I wrote the book, because I've been doing this mission for 10 years, and I send out a blog every morning from a person just known as a missionary. And I thought it's time for people to, the society that we've got, this sort of very secularly driven society, has forced people of faith into a corner almost, kind of inside, like, you know, the theme of the book about walls, like, a lot of Catholics today and Christians and even people of Judaic heritage kind of hiding in their inside their parishes, in their holy huddles. And they're on one side of the wall. And then everyone else is out there pursuing what they've been told by society in some way or another is going to make them happy, you know, kind of lifestyle that's without God. And you know, the harsh reality is we're all created by God, and when we cut ourselves off from Him, we may be happy in some shallow sense, but deep down inside, there's a real spiritual longing for something more. Yet, a lot of these folks out there don't know how to get back. They think they're done, you know, and they're kind of cut off. And what happens on our mission is we encounter people in a kind of very loving, joyful way. We're not preaching on soapboxes. We're mostly asking questions. And if you engage people in that way, you know, you can find that they're almost anxious to have someone invite them back to church. Hmm. And we have some very, very powerful experiences with people that were on their way to a fancy dinner and ended up in church in a Catholic sense in the Sacrament of Confession, which is a big piece for us because it's a place where people can kind of unburden themselves and get kind of break through the wall that's between them and God. And they come out with their lives changed. They thought they were going out to a dinner that night, and they end up in a completely different place. And it's been very, very beautiful. The book is full of these stories.
No, I love the fact that there are bite-sized anecdotes that are all tied together, and whether you're talking about evangelizing or engaging, I should say, with an atheist, that ends up being kind of an evangelization, which is fun. Or just people like this. There's this example of these two folks, Prince and Mott, in Soho on Holy Saturday a couple of years ago. And how this reminds me of me before I became a Catholic. It's like, no, we don't want to go to confession. We've never been. Don't need to. We talk to God on our own.
Right.
But we love you guys just the same. That's, you know, yeah. You hear that a lot from folks. Like, I'm good. I'm good. Thanks. I'm good. I'm good. I talk to God. I'm good. I'm good. I'm good. And then,
yeah,
I don't know. The first time I went to confession, it was kind of scary in a way. It felt a little, you feel so vulnerable. Then it's really great. I hate when I don't go to confession. Like 2 weeks go by, I'm like, oh my God, I gotta hit the box. I mean, I got a lot to say. I'm like, okay, is there a time limit on this?
It's a wonderful sacrament, and it's really funny, Laura, as we talk to people, and by the way, when they tell me they have their own relationship with God, my comeback is usually, well, how's that working for you? And inevitably, it's not working all that well. But it's interesting how many folks we get involved in discussions with that are not Catholics, and they start off maybe a little bit hostile at first, but they quickly mm-hmm. become very loving. And by the end of the conversation, they're asking if they can go to confession. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we always tell them, well, you can't get that sacrament if you're not Catholic, but you can talk to a priest. So we send, you know, non-Catholics into the confessional booth sometimes. It does them a lot of good.
Mm-hmm. Well, one part of the book, which I think everybody, I mean, all of it's great, but when you talked about atheism as probably the fastest growing religion in metropolitan America today. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, 10 years ago when we started it, you know, the atheists were out there, and there's a scene early in the book where I get called a pedophile by one of them. But over time, what we found is that they've become more and more out there, you know, and they almost are beginning to refer to their attitude about God as a faith in itself. I mean, it's become its own sort of religion. And, you know, there's a chapter in the book called Atheists and Other Hostiles, and they tend to be very hostile to people of faith. And our, you know, our approach with those folks, Laura, is to really just try to give them a slightly different angle on what people of faith are like. And if we can leave that encounter with a little bit of joy in their hearts, and they say, well, those folks aren't that bad, I think we've moved the needle a little bit. I mean, I think Rome wasn't won in a day, and mm-hmm. it's very hard to engage in an argument. I mean, as you know, I'm educated at Princeton and Harvard, so I can hang in there with anybody on most issues. But nevertheless, I found it very difficult to win an argument about God with a person who just is adamantly opposed to it. Because in the end of the day, I remember sitting down with Sebastian Younger one night for dinner, and you know, I thought there was some small victory in just getting him to agree that he's also a man of faith. I mean, at the end of the day, you either got to believe that God created the universe, or the universe was created by some neutron that came out of nowhere. I mean, either one seems equally implausible. You know, pick your poison, if you will, or pick your joy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, again, in our society today, where everything, and I find this in my own life, everything is coming at you. You're not really experiencing life as much as life is experiencing you. So to have an extended conversation today, Stephen, with anyone about anything, I mean, a real in-depth conversation is becoming a rarity. That time that these missionaries who work with your mission, your gift of time is this the best gift you can give anybody ever, if you're you know, if you're interested in talking with them or being with them and not looking at a screen or badgering them, if you actually just ask questions about people's lives, you find out a lot. And you also find out a lot about yourself.
Yeah, and it's what keeps the missionaries coming back, because they, when they have a chance to see someone's spiritual life change in a very positive way, and people come out of the church crying and hugging you, you realize you had a big impact. And a key reason I wrote the book, Laura, is one hand, I'd love to get more people to do this actual mission on the streets of New York or San Francisco, or, I mean, there's a lot of city centers where this would work. But on another level, I just think that all of us, folks of faith in particular, need to be braver about getting involved in the cultural dialogue, because without us, it's slipping away in a very negative direction. And I think if you read the book, you come away saying, you know, on the other side of this wall, there's a lot of people who want to have that dialogue. If you can just tap them on the shoulder, you know, and it's kind of remarkable the number of deep spiritual conversations we have out on street corners in Soho.
Yeah, this is one thing I've really always admired about the Mormons. I mean, and they get, look, I mean, they don't give up. I mean, they're ridiculed. They got like one of the hit Broadway shows ridiculing them.
And right.
They like their shirts and ties. Their short sleeve ties. They're like, I don't care. I believe so much in this Mormon thing. I'm going to go out and we're going to require that you go out for, what is it, a year just on a mission? And that's what you do. I mean, whatever you think about Mormonism, that in and of itself is a discipline, which frankly, the Catholics don't have. The evangelicals are much better at it, I think. I think the Catholics have really fallen down on, you know, we're supposed to be fishers of men.
Fishers of men. I mean, you know, again, on the Mormonism, I also admire their determination, and that's one John Broadway I refuse to watch. I don't like to see people
I've never
so
seen it either, but
made fun of. But I would say their approach is a little more typical, and it's a kind of a preachier kind of way to do things. I mean, we take a very kind of Christian approach. I mean, there's one scene in the book, it's a short scene, where these two missionaries are out there, I'm one of them, engaging with people, and there's this Hindu monk watching them. And after about 15 minutes, the monk walks over, and he says, you know, you two, I'm obviously not a Catholic, and I've got my own deal, but I must say, I'm watching you, and the one thing that is obvious to me is you love every single person that you interact with, even the ones that are putting cigars out in your forehead, and that's just really impressive to me. And I think that's what kind of, you know, that's the beauty of our faith. That's what the Lord, you know, what Christ kind of spoke of, and that's what distinguished the early Christians, their love, this sort of, in the Greek form, agape love, self-sacrificing love. And people see that, and there's not enough of that in the world today. It's all one-night stands and hookups and things, and people see that, and they say, I want some of that. Mm-hmm. How do I get that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, again, the wanting to have a relationship with God, wanting to understand Christ, I think that's in so many people. I mean, it's in most people who have been introduced to the concept of our faith. And I think that sadly, so many people forget how Christ brought people into the early church. He brought people into the early church, not just by doing miracles, but by the way he acted. And the way he treated
loving,
people.
Yeah, I call it loving them in, you know. People, the missionaries come to me and say, Steve, what do? I said, love, don't think. Just love them in. And if that doesn't work, joy. Joy's the other one. You know, it's people mistake in this culture joy and happiness. And joy, Christian joy, is confidence. There's a deep-rooted confidence in your future, in eternity. And it gives a Christian a kind of stick-to-itiveness in a joyful way in even the toughest of situations. You know, I can think of times we've been out there in snowstorms and the other hawkers hanging out in Soho, you know, mm-hmm. after about an hour on their way. But the missionaries are out there, you know, covered in snow, because we're having a good time. We're here for the Lord. We're having, you know.
Now, do you approach people who are homeless and down on their luck, or and I read some of this about, you know, the position in the church, like itself, at the table, and people come up to you. What's the typical interaction like? I know that's kind of a silly question. Nothing's typical, but
no,
what is the encounter like?
Well, first of all, I'd say, you know, people down on the luck probably represent about 2-3% of the people that we've brought in. There aren't so many of them in Soho, but we take on all comers, so we've had some wonderful interactions with folks like that. But most of what we do, and this sounds really kind of silly, but we simply ask people, I mean, you got such great pedestrian flow down there. We ask people as they go by, are they Catholic? And it's a very provocative question if you think about it. I mean, first of all, those folks that are not Catholic, they'll say, well, I'm Jewish, and we'll say, well, have a happy Passover. We've had some very interesting interactions with folks of Jewish faith that usually end up really nicely. Mm-hmm. Then there's the atheists that say, you know, been there, done that, or they'll say, God, no. And I'll say, God bless you, and they'll say, thank you. You know, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But the Catholics will, some of them will say they're Catholic, and then we'll start talking to them about the services, and then ask them, hey, have you been to church lately? Have you been to confession? We do ask questions, and we try to get to understand them a little better, and then, you know, hopefully that leads to a decision by them to come back to the church. A lot of them have gone away. Sometimes Catholics will tell us they're not Catholic because they want to, they don't want to have a conversation with us. And mm-hmm. they will sometimes, we don't ever know who said that, but we have many cases of folks that told us they were not Catholic who came back and said, listen, I got to tell you guys, I am Catholic, you know. And I'll say, well, now we've got another sin to deal with. You just lied to me, you know. Because Catholics, I think in their heart, they still long to be part of the church. The other good one, and the book starts this way, actually, is Catholics will try to avoid us by, they'll see us there, and they'll simply kind of walk around us. And when we see someone ignore us, you know, not respond, we almost always guess they're probably Catholic. And we'll pursue those people and say, hey, by the way, I think you might be Catholic. And they go, well, actually, I am. And then the next thing you know, we're having a pretty interesting conversation. Because usually those folks have something on their mind that's bothering them, and mm-hmm. they're trying to avoid it. They're kind of running away.
I like this part. I mean, this is in your afterword in your book. It's like, finally, I want to thank the people of New York, who, despite their reputation for rudeness and toughness, are some of the most loving and deeply spiritual people I've met. Their willingness to spend 15 minutes on a street corner in Soho going deep into matters of faith is quite remarkable. And I think you're right. When you actually engage people with a smile and not judgment, which, again, we're all prone to be judgmental. I mean, I'm probably really badly judgmental. But, you know, at least I know my flaws really well, Steve. I know I'm impatient and judgmental. It's a two of a long list. But when you approach them with a smile.
With a smile
and a sense of joy. And I think there are a lot of, especially a lot of Catholics, they're not a lot of joy. They're not, I mean, this is supposed to be a joyful faith. I mean, the Passion of the Christ ended up in the resurrection. You know, where's our joy? I mean, I hate that, going to Mass and it's like, this is depressing. You need it. You need it to be joyful.
We've got a real branding problem.
Yeah, big. Oh, well, yeah, you think?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to go into Regnum Christi and the Legionaries of Christ. They got some branding problem, but you stuck it out with them, which I admire, man. I mean, Father Maciel's not my favorite. I got to tell you that.
It wasn't mine either.
No. But again, what do you do? I mean, a lot of people are just demoralized. I mean, they're demoralized. They're selling off churches, closing parishes in New York. Good priests don't seem to get elevated in the church hierarchy. A lot of people don't really like this pope very much. You know, I won't tell you what I've said in my confessional about the Pope, but it's, you know, I'm who am I to judge anyone? How do you keep your optimism? You know, how do you not lose faith?
Well, first of all, the church has been through the history of the church. I mean, it's a holy, miraculous institution, but it's been implemented by flawed human beings. We're all flawed.
Yep.
And so it's had its ups and downs over the centuries, but, you know, I try to stay focused on our relationship with the Lord and what we're here for, which is to bring not just ourselves to heaven, but those around us to heaven, and the value of a soul. I mean, someone once said to me, Steve, I mean, the math here, you're an investment guy. I mean, this math is unbelievable. 3 million people you've greeted, and you've brought 15,000 back to confession.
Wow.
That's like 0.05 probability of success. And, you know, I say, well, it's a low margin business, but, you know, we make it up on volume. And you know, 15,000 times eternity on most math is eternity.
That's pretty good.
It's a big thing.
You know, someone might have told you you were good at math and you might do well in business and investment, Steve, with that. That quickie math in your head. By the way, as a totally separate question, you and I are about the same age, I think. You graduated. What, you graduated in college in the 80s, 85? When did you graduate?
78.
Okay, so you're a little older than I am. But you've been incredibly successful. It's a separate matter. I mean, you've done incredibly well, Prudential and Federated, obviously, and I imagine your faith has made you, and your family, your faith and family is what you're holding on to now. I mean, all the success in the world, as you said, doesn't bring you that deep joy. But, you know, you do have to acknowledge you've been really successful, and that's given you a sense of time and freedom that you might not have had to do this other stuff.
That's true. Although, you know, since I kind of had a deep conversion experience about 20 years ago, Laura, mm-hmm. I mean, I've kind of fallen away from the faith. Mm-hmm. Which is probably what partly drives me to try to find these other, you know, ex-Catholics or Sunday Catholics that are out there. Because I was one of them, you know, and mm-hmm. I was fortunate that someone kind of reached over the wall and got me, if you will, and got me back to the faith. But, you know, what I would say is that since I've become a missionary, if you will, to put it that way, my business has become much more successful. I think the assets that I oversee have grown by almost tenfold.
Wow.
You know, the culture of the firm here and our turnover rate, which is very important in an investment business because chemistry amongst the investment people is so important. It's
totally
one of the lowest in the industry. There's a lot of Christian principles that work well in the workplace, even in a workplace of many faiths, right? But prudence, self-mastery, dignity of the individual,
greed,
love,
greed,
respect.
Right, and
greed
and try
doesn't usually work well in the investment business. It usually gets you into trouble.
I like to buy high and sell low myself, Steve, so I know you have a different philosophy, but I like to lose.
I should be running some of your money for you, Laura.
Oh, no. Well, tell me about it.
We'll talk better than that.
Yeah, no. We'll talk. We got some work to do on that front. Steve, let's, you know, we need to get you on the Ingram angle. Would you come on sometime?
I'd love to. Yeah, we talk about markets, you know, global economy, your China problems. March now we're on. Oh my goodness.
Well, you know, at some point you gotta face the beast. Trump's facing the beast, and it's either 21st century is either going to be America's or it's going to be China's, and I'm going to bet on the former. And Trump's the only one who kind of looks at it pragmatically. And I think every time they say that, what about the soybean farmers in Ohio? I say, what about the rest of Ohio? You know, but none of this is going to be pretty. It wasn't pretty over the last 20 years, and it's not going to be pretty to try to reorient things. So I'm a China hawk.
I think we'll get there.
Yeah, no, we're going to totally get there.
I'm always hopeful. I think we'll get there, and I think the president is doing the right thing. He's got to be tough here, but he'll get. I think he's going to get a much bigger deal than people give him credit for. Even on this competition stuff, I think he's already. Think about where we are now, Laura, versus 6 months ago.
Oh my God!
He has shed the light of day on this IP stuff and in property theft. it's harder to steal stuff when the whole world is watching. I think he's already half won this battle.
Yeah, when Tom Friedman is finally acknowledging that China's a problem, as he did today in his New York Times piece, like, am I really reading Tom Friedman? Like, he was like the biggest Sinophile, and even he is saying, well, we got a real problem here. And I was like, okay, thank you. I'm glad. Stephen, you wouldn't know this, but I've been doing the China thing for like 22 years and from the tech transfer issue, and it's... But Trump's really moved the equation, moved the debate on this, no doubt about it.
He's already moved the needle a lot, I think.
Now,
he's accomplished more than people understand.
I have one question, another financial question for you. Trump obviously believes, he's been very explicit on this, that he thinks interest rates need to drop further because the dollar is too strong. He wants to boost U.S. manufacturing, export output. And it's obviously the dollar's very, very strong, harder for U.S. exports. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I disagree with him on that. Although, he was right. He doesn't really get credit for it, but because he does it in such a kind of, in-your-face way. But he was dead right about the Fed in the fall. And I was completely there with him. In fact, we were already forecasting that the Fed was on hold. Even though they were insisting they were going to keep hiking until they caused a recession. So in some ways, he's jawboning just to kind of get their attention. I don't know whether it was with the president or just them coming to their senses, but in a way, he won that battle. So I think to a certain extent, I don't know what motivates the president. I don't know that he really wants them to lower rates.
Well,
I guess lower is always better, but I think where we are now is fine for the economy.
He wants to boost exports.
Low, and things are going pretty fine for us. The market has now flipped to the Fed cutting by the end of the year. We don't think that's going to happen at all. We think the economy is going along 2.5 to 3%. We think rates are probably right. It's going to stay right where they are, which
I
think will be just fine.
Yeah, Steve, remember the experts? I do a segment called The Experts on my show, and I love going back and looking at the so-called experts, okay? Because they never lose their jobs.
Yeah.
They keep getting promoted.
Right.
They keep getting, it's unbelievable. They get literally, if you're a basketball coach, you would have lost your job decades ago with how wrong these people have been about the rise of China.
Right. Guys who 6 months ago were saying that they're
inflation.
The Fed's going to be hiking rates.
Right. It's going to be
inflation.
Yeah. It's going to tank, terrible market.
Rates.
Yeah. So, and then people never go back and say, wait a second, Mr. Krugman, you said, Mr. Nobel laureate, you said the economy is going to tank. You know, all these, and these people get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to be consultants and, I'm like, well, what have you gotten right lately? I'm sorry, but it's just at some point merit should win out. Like, you have a track record of investment. Your track record is phenomenal. So it makes sense that more people want to invest with you. That's just a metric that you can measure. But now what they say you actually have to, you publish it. It's up there. You can compare it to the guy down the street. Okay, this is what we've done. But these people are literally wrong time after time again, and they keep getting promoted. It's the craziest thing ever. But this is why I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. I'm glad I'm doing what I'm doing. And Stephen Auth, I love this book, The Missionary of Wall Street. And the good thing about it is you could read it on a plane ride. It takes you to the streets in New York, which my brother used to live on Bleecker Street, Bleecker and McDougal, and it's right kind of not too far from there. I mean, he's at Greenwich Village, but it's not too far. And it takes you to the streets of New York and real people and their real lives have been changed and can be changed by you every day. And if Stephen can do it with his, with his high flying lifestyle and he can put something together like this, I think a lot of people are going to get inspired. And anyway, love the book and love to have you on the Ingram Angle soon, Stephen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
All right, Stephen Auth, The Missionary of Wall Street. It's featured on lauraingram.com. Also, our Facebook page, so make sure to pick this up. You're going to love it. From managing money to saving souls on the streets of New York. Thanks again to our sponsors who are supporting the show, including Genucel and Delta Animal Rescue. America, now and forever, you're listening to the best of the Laura Ingram Podcast.